This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, Maximum City, is about the largest city in the world, its enormous movie industry, its organized crime, its religious feuds, and how fundamentalism is affecting politics. The city is Bombay. Author Suketu Mehta grew up there. He left in 1977 and came back 21 years later to research his book. As part of that research, he co-wrote a Bollywood musical. Mehta has also lived in London, Paris, New Jersey, Iowa City, and New York, where he lives now. Mehta has written for the New York Times Magazine, Granta, Harper's, and The Village Voice. In his new book, Maximum City, he writes, "With 14 million people, Bombay is the biggest city on the planet of a race of city dwellers. Bombay is the future of urban civilization. God help us." Now, you call the city Bombay and not Mumbai, which is what it's officially known as now. Why won't you call it Mumbai?
Bombay only changed its name, or the name was changed for Bombay, in 1995, when a nativist government that controlled the state of Maharashtra and the city, the political party called the Shiv Sena, changed its name to reflect the way its name is said by some of the people living in the city. Now, Bombay really was a city created by the Portuguese and the British from a clump of malarial islands. And I really felt that to them should go the baptismal rites. And in 1995, when the government demanded that we choose in all our languages Mumbai, that's when a number of the people in the city refused to go along with
so
that edict.
So it's like a political statement that you're making by calling it Bombay.
Very much so, because the politics of this particular party, the Shiv Sena, are really nativist and exclusionist. They run against the cosmopolitan spirit of Bombay. They really are a party that is defined by who they exclude. And so I and many other people in the city refuse to go along with the imposition of a name that excludes other names.
Is it fair to call this party a Hindu fundamentalist party?
You know, Terry, I think the term Hindu fundamentalist is a misnomer because, you know, nobody can really point to anything that is fundamental about Hinduism. It's not a scripture-based religion as the Abrahamic religions. There's really many different... You can be an atheist and be a Hindu. So what they are really is Hindu nationalist. That is, they, along with the BJP party, which used to rule the country until the spring, believe in a kind of national definition of India as a Hindu country, which also runs counter to the principles of the leaders that brought India independence.
Now, you describe Bombay as representing the city of the future. What are the characteristics of Bombay that you think represent the city of the future?
Right. I think, Terry, that the 21st century will be dominated by these vast megacities, mostly in the developing world. The United Nations just came out with a report predicting that by the year 2030, 60% of the planet's population will be living in cities, and 2 billion people will be living in slums. Now, there's a group of cities such as Sao Paulo, Lagos, Jakarta, Kinshasa, Bombay, which are composed of, well, the definition of a megacity is more than 10 million people. But these cities have enormous numbers of people constantly coming in from the countryside and living in these vast shanty towns. They're also marked by a kind of breakdown of civic order and a constant low-level strife. So in the case of the Brazilian cities, tremendous influence by the drug gangs over the affairs of the city. And in Bombay, the underworld specializes in extortion, real estate, and film financing. And really, they've become pretty unpleasant places to live for most of the people in it. But these cities also represent hope for the people coming in from the countryside. They're a beacon of hope for the young people in the countryside. And their growth is added to because of the impoverishment of the countryside, because agriculture is less and less viable in these countries. And part of the reason for that is also the enormous subsidies given to agriculture in the developed countries. So it means that a cotton farmer or a wheat farmer in India can't get a fair price for his crops, and his son will take the first train to Bombay and join the ranks of the people in the swelling shanty towns.
You write also about when you were living in Bombay that all around people asked you for money, your driver, your maid, your friends down on their luck, strangers. How is that different from New York, where at the very least there's no shortage of strangers asking you for money?
Well, the difference is that in New York, we're not very rich. In Bombay, we were very rich because we were coming from New York. So we were at the top of the pyramid, and from all areas, they zoomed in on us. We were like a low pressure system in an area of high pressure. And it got really uncomfortable to have to continuously either bring out our wallet or refuse to bring out our wallet.
So what did you do more often, bring out the wallet or not?
Well, initially, we brought out our wallet quite a lot, and we got ripped off all the time in buying the simplest of services, till we realized that it was a form of newcomer's tax. That is, anybody who comes into a city, any city, in the first year will get ripped off. You'll get ripped off if you're coming to New York and you don't have a network and, you know, you don't know which movers to hire or you don't know where to shop for the cheapest clothes. So for the first year, it was really uncomfortable and we spent much more money than we should have. But then as we got used to it, we realized there were ways in which we could avoid con games, for example, and know who to trust and who not to. And we discovered the best places to shop for bed sheets, computers, and oregano.
Oregano?
Well, we'd come from New York, and one thing we really missed was Italian food. So we ended up cooking a lot of Italian food at home. And I remember the heaviest item in my luggage going to Bombay was a giant can of extra virgin olive oil.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Suketu Mehta, and his new book is called Maximum City, Bombay, Lost and Found. And he grew up in Bombay, now lives in New York, but spent several years there in the late 90s and early 2000s as part of research for this book. Now, you talked to so many different kinds of people for your book when you were living in Bombay, including prostitutes, criminals, politicians who were criminals. And one of those politicians who were a criminal was one of the deputy leaders of Shiv Sena, the Hindu nationalist party that you were talking about earlier. And he actually set a Muslim or two on fire. Tell us first what he did.
This was during the riots following the demolition of the Babri Masjid in India, which was brought down by a Hindu mob in December of 1992. So this set off a chain of riots across the country, and especially in Bombay. And during these riots, he told me about how he met a man who used to sell him bread every day, and he set him on fire for the simple reason that the man was Muslim.
And was there any more provocation than that? I mean, how did he choose this particular man?
Well,
this is one of the things you wanted to know, so that's why I was...
Right. There was this was a man who there was a mob of Hindus who were out early in the morning looking for Muslims to kill, and they found this one poor man coming down the road, they proceeded to assault him and poured kerosene over him. Now, as they did this, the man was weeping and he was crying. He reminded Sunil, the Shiv Sena man, that he used to sell him bread every day, and he was begging for his life, saying that he had children. And the Shiv Sena man, as he set him on fire, said, "When your people were killing our people, did you think of your children?" And proceeded to kill him. So he told me a number of such instances. He and a number of the other Shiv Sena people told me about how they killed Muslims. And people in the Muslim underworld told me how they killed Hindus. It was a question that I often found myself asking in Bombay to all manner of people, Hindus, Muslims, policemen. The question was, what does it feel like to take a human life? And it was astonishing how openly and readily people would tell me about what it does feel like to take a human life. And I found that if I were to continue my inquiry, I really had to, at that particular moment that I was listening to them, withhold judgment. And, you know, I was just recording. As they would talk to me, I'd just write this down on my laptop and I'd have to remain expressionless. I could not show shock or horror or outrage or indignation. I was there. They were telling me what they had been living with all these years. And I was there just writing it down. And for some of them, I felt that, you know, maybe I was performing the function of a shrink. That is, at a certain point, I knew that they had stopped talking to me and were just explaining certain things to themselves. So that was the point where I got the best stories, that where I got to the heart of what murder really is, when they had stopped talking to me and were just explaining some things to themselves.
After the riots in Bombay and Gujarat, in which Hindus were responsible for some killing, do you think that caused a lot of people around the world to reevaluate who Hindus are, what the Hindu faith means, since a lot of people assume that since, you know, Hindus don't want cows killed, that they wouldn't want people killed either?
You know, I think it runs counter to everything that is basic to Hinduism. This kind of aggressive, political, militant Hinduism, it really is a very recent phenomenon. And I've studied Hindu-Muslim riots for a long time. And I think it's a perversion of the religion. It's not even, I think many of the people who do the riots, they don't even justify it on the basis of Hindu scripture, because there isn't anything that they can point to in Hindu scripture which says people who follow Hinduism are damned, or people who follow Hinduism are saved and the others are damned. You know, there is no generally accepted definition of what is a Hindu. So it really is a reaction to modernity. It's a political use of certain religious symbols. It's also a way of mobilizing different caste groups to vote for a particular political party. So the issues are vastly more complex than, you know, religious fervor. Because if you look at the history of India, this kind of rioting is still relatively recent. The roots of it go back no earlier than British times.
My guest is writer Suketu Mehta, and his new book is called Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found. He grew up in Bombay and returned there for several years in the late 90s and early 2000s to live and to research this book. Seeing how Muslims and Hindus do not get along famously in Bombay now, and, you know, having researched what happened in the riots and having spoken to Hindus who describe how they killed Muslims, what is your reaction to seeing the growing role that religion is starting to play in American politics?
I lived in Iowa for 3 years, and so I've seen the growing role of the evangelical churches in the American Midwest. And if people say that much of India is a Hindu nationalist country, then by that definition, much of America is a Christian nationalist country. It's not something that, you know, I see as a welcome development, but I also see that for many of those people in the Midwest, their faith really is a reaction to the more troublesome aspects of modernity. That is, they really don't know how to deal with the modern world and its changing values. And it's the same reason people in India turn to the more extreme manifestations of Hinduism or of Islam. Except in India, the trouble really happens in the larger cities, that is, in urban India, not in rural India. You'll hardly ever hear of religious riots in the countryside. And in America, certainly the values crowd seems to be concentrated in, you know, flyover country. The difference between the two countries also is that this spring, India voted out the BJP. This was the party associated with Hindu nationalism. And, you know, they were mostly voted out for economic reasons, but there was also a large section of the country which felt troubled by this increasing involvement of religion in politics. And I must admit that I was hoping that the same sort of thing would happen here, but it hasn't yet. Maybe America needs to experience a few more years of people who want to eliminate the barriers between religion and politics in public life to really know what it feels like to live with such a government.
You write, since moving to the U.S., I have never believed in boundaries or patriotism. Would you elaborate on that?
Yeah, you know, when I was growing up in India, you know, we'd all sing patriotic songs, and this was in the schools and the playgrounds. And for a time, every time we went in to watch a movie, the national anthem would run, and we would all have to stand up when the anthem was played, on pain of arrest. And then I came to America and found, much the same sort of things. Anthems being played and the flags being waved and this country believing it's the greatest country and the best. And I realized really the lunacy of these notions. So I think that migration is the best antidote to this kind of hyper-patriotism. There should be some sort of pride in place, and, you know, certainly I've got tremendous admiration and respect for both American values and Indian values. And I've also found that they're not very different. The world's oldest continuing civilization and the world's newest. There's always been a cross traffic of ideas of people. For example, Henry David Thoreau and the New England Transcendentalists all read the Bhagavad Gita. And in turn, when Thoreau wrote on the duty of civil disobedience, that book was Mahatma Gandhi's inspiration for launching the Indian freedom struggle. Martin Luther King, in turn, was influenced by Mahatma Gandhi. So I've always found this to be the more important value, this looking outside into the rest of the world. And in the end, I really believe that a passport isn't much more than a travel document.
One of the things you got to do when you were living in Bombay is to co-write a Bollywood musical called Mission Kashmir.
Right.
And how did
they're you... all musicals.
They're all musicals, yes. How did you get to write for Bollywood?
Well, I wanted to study Bollywood from the inside. Now, I realized early on in my stay in Bombay that, you know, I'd always grown up with Bollywood. I love the movies. And I realized that I couldn't just go around interviewing people. Most of these people are very busy. They have no time for journalists, Indian or foreign. So the only way I could really understand the making of this fascinating industry was to work in it. That is, to follow the construction of desire in these movies from the inside by making myself useful to them. So when a writer friend of mine invited me to come along to a story session that his brother-in-law, a famous movie director, was doing, I came along, and the director started asking me questions when he found I was a writer. And before long, I became part of the script writing team for a movie called Mission Kashmir, which is a film ostensibly about war-torn Kashmir, but with song and dance.
So you had to show the film to the censor board of India. What are the parameters for censorship in India?
All of these films are very heavily censored to a degree that would be unthinkable in the U.S. That is, you're not allowed to have nudity, you're not allowed to have open sex, you're not allowed to have swear words. So it really stifles cinema in India. And the censor board is really made up of people often who are very ignorant about cinema. They're drawn from the community, that is, respectable middle-class people, somewhat like the Texas State Textbook Commission. So I've actually sat in on meetings of the Indian Censor Board and watched them censor films on political grounds. That is, it would make the police look bad, or it would make the a particular political party look bad. And the country accepts this. So as a result, most of these Bollywood films and even the South Indian films, they get by on lots of double entendres and innuendo and, you know, the famous wet sari scene in which the heroine will accidentally get drenched in the rain and will dance around with her sari becoming progressively more transparent. It's really quite disturbing when you're trying to get across political ideas which reflect what's happening in the country, and the censor board says that that the country is absolutely not ready for this.
Where did the songs come in?
The songs, Terry, I think are the most delightful part of the Bollywood films. And there's a long tradition in India of advancing narrative through music. So you'll find this in the folk theater of the country, in the religious epics, the way they're told. They'll be singing and dancing. And the song isn't, it's not just a diversion from the plot. It actually advances the plot in many ways. And even if it doesn't, it's fine because people come there to have a complete entertainment. You know, there's a film out right now called Veer Zara, which I'd also followed the making of, which is almost 3.5 hours long. Now, you know, most Americans would be killing themselves if they had to sit through a 3.5 hour film. But for the Indian viewer, you know, he's worked all day in the villages and in the evening, he really wants value for his money. He wants to sit for 3.5 hours and watch these gorgeous people dance and have troubles and resolve them at the end and have, you know, families reunified. He wants it all. He wants action. He wants a bit of titillation. He wants song and dance. Because, you know, when he goes back, there isn't that much to go back for. So the films are kind of an exaggerated reality. And even the singing, you know, often the singing really, it escapes logic altogether. There'll be a pair of lovers, they'll be walking down Bombay Street, and the man will look at the woman and start singing, and all of a sudden they'll be magically transported to the Alpine valleys of Switzerland. And no one in the audience will blink an eyelid and think, well, this can't really happen.
So do you think you'll ever live in Bombay again?
I think so, Terry. You know, when I started this book, I began it with a simple question, which is, can you go home again? And I found after 2.5 years living there that not only can you go home again, you can also leave again. And now I can go back and forth between, you know, I realized that home for people like us isn't a geographically intact entity. That is, I have a room of my home in New York, I have another room in Bombay, another one in Paris, and I can move between the different rooms of my home as if it really were linked. And in the end, home is where my people are, and my people are in the cities of the world.
Your family's in the cities of the world. Your family's dispersed around the world.
That's right. I've got extended family in London and in New York, in San Francisco, in Bombay, in Antwerp. And I've got friends in other cities. And it really, there is a sort of global city culture in which if you take people like me and many people like me, and you throw us in just about any of these global cities, we will find our feet. And, you know, in all of these cities, even Bombay and Lagos and Jakarta, the first world lives right in the smack, right smack in the middle of the third world. And there are these islands of convenience and prosperity within great seas of squalor.
Suketu Mehta, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Suketu Mehta is the author of the new book, Maximum City.